We're on page 20 of the apologetics note. Entering into our second consideration of the teleological argument is that there is purpose in nature. I want to read after W.H. Fichte, F-I-T-C-H-E-T-T, of England, in his book, The Beliefs of Unbelief. I like that. It's like, I've read many books like The Difficulties of Unbelief. They always talk about the difficulties of believing. I think there are a whole lot more difficulties in unbelief than there are in belief. I cut this out of a periodical. That was his book, but I read the article and since he was an Englishman. In 1953, I cut it out of Prophecy Monthly. And here's the quotation. The highest expression of mind is to take a number of unconscious, unrelated things and set them in relationships which make them a channel of meaning, of which they themselves are unconscious. Servants of intelligence, purpose, of which they know nothing. And he gives three or four examples. For example, the letters of the alphabet form a cluster of unrelated symbols, each standing for one of those separate airwaves we call sound. Put them together, and what do you find? You have a sermon, a song, a business letter, a novel. There are seven notes of music, and they're all in nature, and they exist independent of man. A succession of vibrations on the air which has no mind. Beethoven knits them together, and melody and harmony are interwoven in the beautiful music. The Moonlight Sonata is the bringing together of seven notes plus Beethoven. I like that. Not plus Bragg. You'd have a concacophony. He says that we have the 26 letters in the alphabet, but no Hamlet without Shakespeare. We have seven notes, but without Handel, there's no Messiah. Here's this application. It is hard then to believe that the unrelated elements of the physical universe, or is it hard? Is it hard then to believe that the unrelated elements of the natural universe, or physical universe, must have had an infinite controlling mind to make them the servants of a controlling intelligence to result in the harmonious universe? Good argument to me. Unity in the physical world is a proof of intelligence behind it. We can no more ascribe it to chance or evolution than we could the safe arrival or departure of thousands of trains from Waterloo Station by chance, or the thousands of planes that come in and go out of O'Hare Airport. The guy just sits up there and mashes a whole bunch of buttons down like this. He's playing on that thing, having all kinds of fun. And you look out there and you get a pile of airplanes a couple miles high. The order and intelligence shows what? I should not say intelligence. Order and design in the whole outfit shows that there must be a controlling mind behind it. Now, this is the whole idea of teleology, is final cause, as you should see as we go along. How can it be the fortuitous concourse of atoms, as they say the human was designed from? And here's another word to be corrected. Theology should be teleology. Right after second consideration. This is true teleology. Not theology. It is true theology too, but that's not the thing with which we're dealing. This is true teleology from the Greek teleos, end, so direction toward a definite end or purpose. Here also is the other meaning of the word design, which not only means pattern or blueprint, but intention as a verb to design something. Always carries the idea of an end in view. Final cause. Hence, there is intelligent supervision in nature toward a desired, designed, intended end. All things in nature. A-L-L-L. Oh, no, just two L's. A-L-L. All things in nature are not haphazard, but for a definite purpose. I know that many times an evolutionist will say, we don't know of any purpose in this, but that doesn't mean there isn't one there. Serving a desired end and doing it to an amazing degree. Now, this is called in teleology, final cause. The end for which it was designed. Now, stated briefly, the principle of final cause is nature exhibits everywhere to the finest degree the evidence of purpose or end in all of its forms, functions, adaptations. And these evidences form an infallible proof of intelligent origin as well as supervision by an intelligence over nature for a desired end. There is intentionality in all of nature, from the largest to the smallest details. Everything serves a design purpose, and that to an almost infinite degree, where you can't imagine any change at all in it that wouldn't ruin the final purpose for which it was designed, as we will see in the human body. From the construction of a leaf to an elephant, it is serving perfectly its designed purpose. There has to be some originating, controlling intelligence. I'll show you that from several evolutionists, atheistic evolutionists. They have to postulate some kind of unconscious intelligence as the latest invention. We always ask after saying that, what's that? Unconscious intelligence. Everything that man makes, even his doodling on a piece of paper, not only has designs, but it shows the pattern of his mind. Did you know a good psychologist? I'm talking about a real good one. You take your doodlings and pretty well pick your brains. Know what you're thinking and what kind of a person you are, your personality. Even many could take your handwriting and tell quite a bit about you. Whether it slants backwards or slants forward, or it's closed O's and closed D's and all the rest. I know they go to overboard sometimes, but find things that are not there. I see a watch. I see beauty. I see design, I see pattern, very symmetrical, balanced. But is that all? The answer is no. This thing's made to tell time. And if it doesn't do it, you're ostentatious if you wear the thing. Because you wear it to be able to tell what time it is when you need to. Like we've always said, a stopwatch tells time accurately at least twice a day. But a running watch doesn't keep time. It never does get there. It's always wrong, period. A house is made a habitation or some other definite purpose, not just haphazardly. An automobile, even for all of its chrome, all of its beautiful color, made for locomotion, carry the individual. So the eye is made for seeing, and the ear for hearing, and the leg for locomotion, the vocal cords for speaking. What else? You ever stop to think, and we shall see as we go along. The eye is, in some 137 million parts, we shall see, is an admirable organ for seeing. Happy accident, isn't it, that you can see through those two things. They're kind of aggravation otherwise. Why have them? We'll see a little later some other things about the eye, of course. I go out in the woods, out in the middle of nowhere, and I see a path. But as I look at it, it is a jumbled up mess. Broken trees and broken down this and broken down that and rooted out this and rooted out that, and it's haphazard at just a little ways and doesn't lead anywhere and doesn't come from anywhere. Pretty apt to be caused by a cyclone. I've gone out in the woods and seen a cyclone's path. But if you go out and find a path and it's very symmetrical and it's cleared out and it crosses a creek but a bridge, and I go in one direction, I find a hut. I go in the other direction, I find a well. I'm riding pretty closely. I say, isn't that a wonderful tornado that can do a thing like that? Now, that's what the evolutionists ought to say. The atheists ought to say it. It wasn't designed at all. It designed itself for no reason. Remember, utility is the yardstick of intention, as you'll say later in your notes. I borrowed that from somebody else, too. If a thing perfectly serves a certain purpose, it must have been made for that purpose. That's the idea of the thing. Otherwise, why is it there? Now, why should I consider that every organ in nature, everything in nature serves a purpose? And does it perfectly the way you can't understand how that purpose could have been accomplished any other way? Here we're further removed from chance than in the idea of pattern. We can conceive of a cyclone making a certain design or a waterspout making a certain design, but when we see an intentional thing in it, in nature or in man's works, we have to say that it must have been designed for that reason. Here, chance is a lot less likely than it is even in pattern. Chance is excluded. Let me illustrate. What if the first astronauts that landed upon the moon walked out a little ways, and they saw a large cylindrical metal spaceship-like vessel? They approach it, and they see a door in it, and quite a few other things, aerials. But they say, that's a meteorite. Explosion on the moon made that thing. Not a soul on the face of the earth would be that dumb. They'd say, I don't know how, why, or when, but the Russians have beat us to it. Anybody who believes that also would have to be a fool. They wouldn't, if they could have landed a man on the moon before us, they'd have done it. But they weren't that sophisticated, even though they were ahead on throw weight. They were not ahead of us on miniaturization nor in sophistication. We know that a human's been there. Especially if we found Kilroyd was here on one of the rocks. All of us remember almost from our high school physics or high school science class the canals on Mars. Then for years and years and years postulated that there had to be intelligent life on Mars that made those canals. Until the Voyager went by. Took some pictures. And they knew then that there weren't any canals at all. They were made by natural forces, not by humans. They were great rifts, somewhat like Rift Valley in eastern Africa, and running all the way up to across the Mediterranean Sea. I see a thing that they call a piano. Beautiful, symmetrical, varnished, lift the front outfit there, and there are keys, white and black. White for one thing and the black for half keys. And then the fellow says, I play between the cracks. That's what I say, by the way, is between the tracks. Then I lift the great big top to the thing, and lo and behold, there's a great big harp in there. And there are all kinds of strings, some single, some double, some triple. And I put my finger down on a key, and a note comes out. I say, what a happy, fortuitous concourse of atoms. Made this beautiful piano. My wife has one in her house, and she'd love to have one of those baby grands, not a concert grand, a house would hold it. Now, here we not only have design and pattern, but we have intention, purpose. Now, every science witnesses to this final cause. Now, we want to take some sciences, and we're going to give a lot out of your notes and a little in your notes. I'd love to have time to give the notes and then my other illustrations in relationship to it. But time won't permit. Our first science is on page 22, the science of botany. I have a couple college textbooks on this that I quote from. One of them, Botany, Journal of Botany for College, says there are 250,000 known species of plants upon the earth. Known. They're finding new ones, by the way, every day. But he says there are 250,000 known. That's 250,000 varieties. Why? Give no reason for it. Here we call our first witness to the stand to testify to the intention and nature. Here, as in every other science in the vegetable world, there's not chaos, order, and arrangement, pointing to purpose in the most minute part. Even more so under the microscope, just by the human eye. We have to give this first one since it's the basic one. The whole mystery of fructification or reproduction after its kind. Every living thing, since it's a dying thing, must reproduce itself. or replicate itself, or the species dies. Period. Since every living thing is dying, every living thing then must reproduce. There must be a fixed principle within every living thing whereby it can replicate itself, keep the species alive. Here's the whole mystery of the whole lifespan or life cycle tied up in the seed of every living thing, carrying all the inherited characteristics of the parent stock and the prophecy of all of its future. Like the watermelon seed. Little black thing, you put it in the dirt, and the dirtier the dirt, the better it grows. It germinates, it sprouts, it grows into a vine, flowers. In a few short months, it lifts from the soil through its roots and binds the material to build one or more 40 to 75 pound watermelons. I have seen one heavier than 75 pounds. One man, you try lifting a 75 pound watermelon. It's so awkward. No corners on the thing. If I was around it very long and it were ripe, I'd have some corners on it. Then that same vine, that same little seed, potentially, it paints it with the beautiful colors gathered from the same black dirt. Black seeds, sunset red meat, bright green rind, and from the same black dirt to gather the flavoring and sugar to make it edible, so that its seeds will be carried elsewhere. Yet the whole force resides in that little black seed. See the wonderful diversity of purpose in nature to see the propagation of itself by getting its seeds spread. How can you see that little black seed saying, "Here comes that Florida cracker Bragg, and he loves watermelon. If we're going to get our seeds scattered, we've got to do something to make him eat us. And so it suddenly squeezes up its little juices and begins to get sugar out of that black dirt and beautiful flavoring out of it. And I like watermelon. So I've scattered quite a few seeds in my day. Watermelon seeds. But I've scattered them. Even used to use like this, you pinch them like this and see how far you can make them go. And then, of course, they have spitting contests. Almost every watermelon feast. And then, of course, you use the watermelons. I can remember one time at Trinity College. I better not tell you this. I'm going to get a lot of you shipped if you try it. We had a watermelon cutting After we got all through, we tried to find the girl of our choice to smear the watermelon rind on her face. You know, that's strange. That's macho. I don't know why the girls like to have their faces smeared with watermelon rind. Well, I guess she didn't like it, but she had to laugh anyhow. But that's got a lot of seeds. I'm not saying that the watermelon knew this and worked it all out so that the girls would get the watermelon in their face and the seeds would get scattered all over the campus. But they didn't let it grow anyhow. The evolutionist says Mother Nature planned it. Bless her pointed little head. Mother Nature must be grand. They always capitalize her. She not only has to be infinite in knowledge, she has to be omnipresent. And she has to be immutable and eternal. Look at the various methods of scattering seed. In a book I have by Ray Ethan, Botany for Colleges, page 135, he says, "Hence all sorts of devices." I want you to notice this word. I get these in every evolutionary book. I get it in every atheistic book. all the language of teleology. How can nature have a device, create a device to do anything? He says all sorts of devices are utilized to affect the seed's distribution. End of quotation. The seeds must be scattered if the species is to continue. Now, besides what we've already said about something sweet around the seed, like all fruits, that makes animals, birds, man want the sweet. Now, here's the amazing thing. In quite a few of those seeds, there is a coating that withstands the chemical reaction within the stomach, or in a bird in the craw, that one eating. Most of your berries, like raspberries and strawberries and blackberries and buckberries and blueberries, the seeds go through undigested and are scattered all over the place. There are many devices in order to propagate the seed. The one I call to your attention in the notes. For instance, the burrs, like the beggar lice and the barbed seeds and Spanish needles, and famous Florida sand spurs, the cocklebird, sticking to the fur and clothes and hair of anything passing by. In fact, one of the most aggravating things is walking through the woods, if you're hunting or fishing or anything like that, and walking through the woods and all of a sudden you itch from your belt to your shoes. And there's a spine thing about that long that goes up your britches leg. And then sticks into you. Just walking through the woods. Never will forget the first time I walked through one of these patches. And then try to find a place to take my britches off to get the spines out of my legs. All kinds of stick tights, as they call the beggar lice. They're the wind-driven seeds, such as all the conifers. There are, and thistle downs, and there are also even plants that swing out their seeds. Get them out, away from them. Now that's not exhausting it, but a lot more. Is all this accidental? Or the design for that purpose? Now, we won't go into the like producing like. We'll be dealing with that all the way through apologetics. After his kind, Genesis says, the smartest men on earth have been trying to break that law. Not a one's ever been able to do it. They have never created a new species. Here's why, since they can't do that, they've been redefining species. They say, oh, there's no such thing as species. Of course, if evolution is true, you couldn't have species. It'd be a hodgepodge from the lowest to the highest, and no missing links at all. They'd all be there, not a one missing. The very fact that, as we will see later, and I give it later in under botany, Luther Burbank took a whole lifetime trying to prove evolution and trying to make a new species. And he made very many variations, but never a new one. Mutations are everywhere, but transmutations, they never have made one. They've never made a brand new species using all the ingenuity that man can possibly bring to bear. They've never created by artificial insemination, by artificial breeding, they've never been able to bring about a brand new species. Like I say in anthropology, they can't do like Mutt and Jeff when Mutt was trying to make a brand new species and he said he was crossing a jellyfish with a pig to get boneless ham. He didn't succeed either. Here's what they call, there's great success in lateral variations within a species. Not a new one, within a species. But no horizontal to bring out a brand new species. Not a one. People, when they criticize the ark, do not realize that he didn't take every variation within a species into the ark. He needed to take one pair of canines, from which the dog family, the wolf family, the fox family, there are dozens of members like there are of the feline family, the cat family. He would have to bring one of each one. Just one of the species, or two of the species, I should say. And the variations come from that. Horses, just one set. Man has never been able, and by the way, they've been arguing about species. This book that I've got argues about species, and he denies that there are species. He tries to redefine it. But I believe the most accurate, as the Bible gives it, after its kind, the most accurate, I believe, is that whole question of fertility. Born from mating mules, but very few. But there are still the equestrians, what is a horse's family? Skips my mind right now. I think of the rider, equestrian, or whatever it is. But I forgot what the horse family is. Cow family, bovine, each one has a name. I'll pick up. What? I don't think that's it. It's not important anyhow. It'll still stay a horse. I want to give the illustration of symbiosis. I'll read it for you. I spell it SYMBIOSIS. Symbiosis. It's in botany as well as in zoology. It's in the human family. Symbiosis, for instance, what we're going to use is the development of two separate lines, and they complement each other, and one lives because the other lives and couldn't live without the other. Symbiosis is unrelated things in nature depending upon something else. And by contributing one to the other what they contribute, they both live. Or reproduce, whichever you want. Two unrelated lives depending upon each other are perishing. How do they get together? How live until they do? In fact, all the way through, in biology in particular, but there is the sexes also in botany, the fact of the two sexes, male and female, runs throughout all of nature in living things. And the perpetuation of the race depends upon symbiosis, each contributing their own separate part to the reproduction. I don't know how in the world, and of course, I have never read anywhere where any evolutionist really explains the presence of sex, male and female. Let me give you this illustration to be sure I've got time. It's the illustration of the yucca plant. That's its official name. We call it in Florida Spanish bayonet. And the pronuba moth, P-R-O-N-U-B-A. And I'm going to take this. I had it in my notes before I ever got this book by Torrey. I'm going to read after Torrey's General Botany for Colleges, page 129. He calls this symbiosis between the yucca plant and the pronuba moth a puzzling pollination event. And he makes it all capital N, A-T-U-R-E, nature. Divides the whole thing. And then on page 131, we cannot even attempt to explain the evolution of such a symbiotic system. When we realize that half of the wasps are sacrificed in female cannibalization, like so many of the insects. I wouldn't want to be a Mr. Moth or a Mr. Praenanthus or so many misters in the insect world because they get eaten. When his lady love invites him to supper, she doesn't tell him he's the supper. And the other half of the moths live a very dangerous life and are dependent upon the yucca plant for perpetuation. Now, continue the quotation. The life history of the flower is synchronized to the life history of the wasp. How in the world could that happen by chance? Or by nature? He says, we cannot understand. For here he says, we are on the boundary of some knowledge whose source gives way to metaphysics. He won't say God. Continuing his quotation, the yucca or Spanish bayonet is mostly in the southwest. But I say in Florida also, I had them next to my house. I've got them next to my house in Newport Rich. I had them in Miami, Florida. We had plenty of them over at Temple Terrace. The moth is called pronuba moth. The female insect flies to the open flower where she molds a small ball of pollen and then runs up the style and crowds the pollen ball into the cup-shaped stigma, as she may repeat this several times in the same plant or in other plants. And there's not a soul in the face that will tell you why she does this. It doesn't seem to be for her own sake or the little moth that eats other parts of the flower. Now, finally she climbs down again to the plant ovary and thrusts her ova depositor through the capillary wall and lays her eggs in the oval. The pollen grains which she shall place on the stigma sends down their tubes. The seeds begin to develop and the larva of the pronuba moth feeds on the growing seeds. Some seeds always escape destruction, and thus the yucca plant gains, even if it does lose so much. Now, I want you to notice what he says. We call this unreasoned adaptation. After all this, metaphysics, he says. Unreasoned adaptation. As that of the pernuba by the name of instinct. That doesn't help a bit to call it something. Where'd it come from? It explains nothing. There's much more that I could give on the pernuba moth. I want to get through this section. I want to give a little on the color green. In botany, everyone knows that, that's in the middle of page 24, but I'll give most of it outside your notes. I'm not going to give why is all nature colored green and why green is the most restful color in nature. While yellow is the most antagonizing one. Red is the most, not distracting as yellow. Actually, yellow will run you crazy if you don't watch it. If you could be shut into a bright room and it painted bright yellow, I think your mind would go, is it?
Yeah? I want to know if that was reason for shading these walls.
Probably so. It's keep you all awake. I think maybe the next one's going to be very bright. Maybe translucent yellow with a little sound in it. We're going to go to the symbiosis of plants and animals, and man and plants. Why God put so much green in nature? God says in His Word, "I have given you every green herb for meat. Every green herb for meat." Most scientists know that only what is alive, or once was alive, was ever meat for food. All inorganic chemicals, drugs, and minerals, or incomplete or decomposed or transformed foods, are not only unfit for food, but they'll kill you if you're not careful. Here's why practically every medicine that man makes, because most of them are chemical, has to be taken strictly under a doctor's instructions or it'll kill you. There isn't a medicine you take that doesn't have contradistinctions, every one. Because they're not natural foods. They're not natural for you at all. They weren't living. Most people have the idea if it's a medicine and if one pill is good for you, two is twice as good, three is three times as good, if you take a whole bottle, you'll solve all your problems. It does. Very neatly as they bury you. Here's why all of the manifold chemicals and minerals that are being added as so-called additives to our food and drink are dangerous to your health. Many of them are carcinogenic. They form cancer. Many of them are indigestible. Many cause tumors. The United States Department of Agriculture has banned quite a few. They started a little late, so they've got a great big whole catalog of over 500 that weren't included in the ban. Most of the additives were not added for your benefit. They were added for to be able to sell it and to make it look good. They were adding, for instance, sugar to all baby foods. Remember they got after Gerber about this here about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. Not because the baby wouldn't eat it without sugar. They can't tell the difference. But the mother always tasted it and didn't taste good to her, so she felt like a baby would eat it. The nitrates added to all smoked meats was not added for your benefit. It was added for two reasons. One, to take away that sickly color that most meats have. Ham and bacon have a putrid, sick color to it if they didn't add the coloring. Then they add the nitrates for shelf life. It doesn't spoil your soup. You'd be amazed if you knew the hamburger you eat at dinner, how many additives have been put in there. And most of them have a kind of a killing habit. Let's come now to this symbiosis. Maybe we'll get it in. The leaf is the marvelous food factory created by only God. No man can make a leaf. A living leaf. Green is the universal food factory made up of chlorophyll in all living plants. It's nature's most plentiful, proficient, and complicated food process. No man has ever learned the secret of photosynthesis that changes minerals in edible foodstuffs into food, carbohydrates, proteins, other things that you can digest. Every leaf has on its underside countless pores, called by botanists stomata. The ordinary apple leaf has over 100,000 in each leaf. And the average oak tree has over 700,000 leaves. And every one is a food factory. And these green leaves, of whatever shape they are, in the ocean or out of the ocean, anywhere else, are the only food factories on earth. It can change all the inedible, indigestible, minerals, substances on earth, carbons, into carbohydrates and proteins. I think maybe I'll give just a little bit more of that in the next lesson because it's very important in botany and skip some other things. I don't want to just read what I put down to you in the class. I want to bring some extra ones in to illustrate our teaching. But read the notes. Read ahead here in particular a little bit. You're dismissed.